From the makers of Rice-A-Roni comes Macaroni, a creamy, delicious boxed mac and cheese that's not just good, it's cheesy good. Macaroni will please even the pickiest eaters with two magnificent flavors that will melt your heart, creamy cheddar and creamy white cheddar. If you love cheese, you'll love Macaroni by the makers of Rice-A-Roni. If you don't love cheese, well, that's just unbelievable. Try Macaroni. It's cheesy good.
Macaroni, the San Francisco treat.
Screen Time with John Fardy.
Thanks to Airtainment, a new era in Irish streaming begins. Discover more at airtainment.com.
This is News Talk.
Now you're welcome to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. We're coming to you at the later time of 9 p.m. this week due to a rugby match. We have a very special show for you this week because it's that time of year. And despite the fact that we constantly hear about the death of cinema and even sometimes TV, 2024 has been a bumper year for some great movies and indeed great TV shows. And if you don't believe me, I have two powerhouses of movie and TV watching in the form of arts journalists and film critic Chris Wasser and author and journalist Aoife Barry, who are going to give me their top threes, fives, that kind of thing. And of course, this isn't a normal radio show with a normal host who should just sit back and let his guests talk. But with my unfettered ego, I will also be giving you my top threes and fives. Chris and Aoife, you're very welcome.
Delighted to be
here. How are you, John? How are you?
Very well. So, and Aoife, I should say, we're very grateful you're here because you are struggling slightly with a winter cold. So we do appreciate that.
No bother at all. Yeah, please excuse my voice. Very nasal sounding voice this week.
I've heard a lot worse. So we'll battle on. I've heard a lot worse on this station and others. And I should say to anyone listening, screentimeatnewstalk.com is the email address if you want to join the conversation. So I think it was a pretty good year for movies. I didn't think that all year long, but when I looked back and I saw some of your lists. So if it's okay, because two of us had this in our list, if not even three of us, I was going to start with this. So,
well, I thought you'd be hairier. Like your dad.
Okay, sorry.
Like a hairy chest myself.
Okay.
Christ, you know who you remind me of?
Who?
You look just like my dad.
Did he?
I remember him anyway when I was a little girl. God, isn't that mad? It's like seeing you both exactly the same time.
Well, that was a clip from All of Us Strangers, which was released in January of this year. Seems like a lifetime ago now. And you heard the wonderful Andrew Scott there talking to, I suppose you might say, the ghost of his mother of sorts, even though she's very real in front of him, played by Claire Foy. This was on my list of one of my favourite movies of the year and the best movies of the year because I have thought about it many times since. I remember weeping in the cinema watching it, which doesn't happen that often. Chris, you had this on your list. Why did you love All of Us Strangers?
I thought it was just a beautiful piece of work. And you mentioned the ghost element there. I think it's odd that the ghost element was sort of hidden from the marketing. And, you know, when I found myself talking to a lot of people when after I saw an early screening of this. And when I mentioned the fact that, you know, it is about this writer who has kind of, you know, locked himself away from the rest of the world as he struggles with this project, the writer being Andrew Scott's character. When he stumbles upon his parents who actually died when he was 10, but he discovers that they're, for him at least, they're living in his old childhood home. When I was talking to people about that, the reaction I was getting was, well, oh, I didn't know it was a ghost story. But that's not as gimmicky or as silly as it sounds. It does take inspiration from a Japanese novel that was previously adapted into a film. But it kind of Andrew High's version of it. He's the writer and director here. It kind of goes its own way. And although you might think that, okay, look, is this a although you might be thinking, okay, it's a supernatural film. It is first and foremost a drama. And for me, I found the ghost element very easy to take in because stories like these are always. They're always a lot more digestible and they're always a lot more engaging when they're populated by real people with real problems and real things to say. And that's very much the case with Andrew Scott's character, with his neighbor who lives upstairs, who he has a romantic relationship with, brilliantly portrayed by Paul Mescal. The relationship that Andrew Scott's character has with his parents, played by Jamie Bell and Claire Foy. Jamie Bell here is just a revelation. I mean, he's always been a good actor, but a little bit underappreciated. But his performance as the writer's father is just, it's just so moving, and probably the best of his career. Just their relationships are so naturally portrayed, and the writing is excellent. The chemistry between Mescal and Scott is wonderful. It's a lovely, lovely film, a heartbreaking one. I mean, it will improve your day, but it also might spoil it in a way. You know, you might need a Disney film lined up for afterwards. But it was one of the first films out the gate at the beginning of the year, and it's one of the last ones that I'm thinking about at the end of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you talked about such natural performances. Andrew Scott in this, you know, it sounds like a pretentious thing to say, an organic performance, but you almost felt like you were, I don't know, somehow watching him in a documentary, or yes, you were sitting across a table with him. And you mentioned Ghost Story. Like, I would just be hesitant. I don't want people to think this is The Sixth Sense or anything, because it's ghosts. It is ghosts in one sense. He is literally seeing dead people, but it's that blurred line between the ghosts in our head and that kind of stuff. It is just absolutely beautiful. Aoife, did you get to see it?
Yeah, I did. And as I was doing up my list of films, I kept thinking, oh no, maybe I should put this actually into my list of my top five, because it is really beautiful. It's really, really moving, and really kind of a sexy film as well, and really sad film. It really is about grief and about what we lose when our family slips away from us. And it's about identity. And I think for British people in particular watching it, it's kind of got a lot, and I think for Irish people too, I think there's something particularly British in it, because it's a British director, mm-hmm. and it's about a British man, to do with things like Section 28, where they couldn't mention like homosexuality in schools and things like that up till, I think it was into the 90s, maybe early, late 80s. I think there's that cultural issue there that also translates into what it's like to be LGBTQ in Ireland as well. So I think that layer of it was really interesting as well to watch, and to wonder how people were connecting with that personal level of identity and being allowed to be yourself or not allowed being allowed to be yourself. And I think there's that political level, I think, comes through from a British aspect in it, but I think people, Irish people, will heavily resonate with that as well too.
And I should mention, for the next 40 minutes or so, I will be constantly name dropping, but I do have to mention that when I spoke to the guys for this movie, in particular Andrew Hay, who Chris mentioned, something I hadn't realized, and think about this, he filmed it in his old house. So this was a story he'd kind of written on the Japanese novel based on ghosts of the past and all that kind of stuff. But he went and filmed it in the house he grew up in. It just seems imponderous. But I think we all agree, a gorgeous, beautiful movie, All of Us Strangers. If you haven't seen it, do check it out, because Chris, me, and Aoife Barry are saying it is one of the films of the year. So Aoife, where would you like to begin with your selection?
I think I'll begin with the film that I feel like has haunted me for the whole year in a good way. You know the way every year you have a film that you're like, oh my God, when I think back on that year, I'll think back on this film, and just the experience of sitting in the cinema and watching this and how I felt afterwards. And it's La Chimera, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, mm-hmm. by the director Alice Rohrwacher, who's an Italian-German director, and it stars Josh O'Connor. And this year there was a lot of hype around Josh O'Connor in Challengers, which I also really loved. I really enjoyed that film a lot. It was great. But in this, he plays a guy called Arthur, a British man in the 1980s who gets involved in Italy with a group of grave robbers who I think are called Tomboli in Italian. And it's set at a very specific time when there is these grave goods from the Etruscan era that were particularly of note and would get a lot of money in the black market. And there is eventually a law that came in, I think in the late 1980s, that meant people would be punished for stealing these goods. And he gets involved with a group of people who are these kind of like gang of ne'er-do-wells, this really weird kind of gang of people in this small town in Italy. And they steal these grave goods, and he is going through this like really tough personal experience himself. We realize he's lost his girlfriend, and he just kind of is deteriorating physically and mentally. And he wears this amazing white suit. He looks like Mark Twain or something like that. And the suit gets dirtier and more shabby the whole way through the film. It's just, I was so spellbound by this. It's like a fairy tale, like a dark fairy tale from hundreds of years ago. It's so fantastical. It's so gritty. It's like the cast is unbelievable. Josh O'Connor speaks Italian throughout this film. I mean, wow. What the hell? He's so good. The film really stuck with me. I think because it goes to really dark places and unexpected places, but at the same time, it has kind of a whimsical element to it, mm-hmm. as well. So yeah, I can't wait to rewatch it. And it's one of those ones you're like, I'd love a poster of that film to stick up on the wall to show how much I love it. You know, so yeah, I'm going to have to get one of those.
That's a telltale sign. If you want a poster from a movie,
yeah,
and you're still a very young woman, but you're not a child anymore, Aoife. So, I mean, that's saying something. So that's Chimera, which I didn't get to see. Did you, Chris?
I did, yeah. I thought it was beautiful. And what a year for Isabella Rossellini as well.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, garnering a lot of attention and awards buzz because of her performance in Conclave. But she plays the late girlfriend that Aoife mentioned there, her mother in this, who is rather taken with Josh O'Connor's disheveled Englishman. And I should say, I thought Josh O'Connor, mostly, I think he's in that scruffy white suit for the entirety of the film, which is a commitment. I mean, you can practically smell him at some point. But I thought it was a lovely performance by him, and such a different one as well from the one in Challengers, because he is this gifted, would-be archaeologist who's turned into like this kind of glorified grave robber. And he's obviously kind of, you know, he obviously has some sort of, there are hints of the supernatural there. He obviously has some sort of talent. He has a knack of knowing where things are in the ground underneath them. But I love that message that Alice Rohrwacher had throughout the whole film, that this guy is just digging for something he's never going to get. He's looking for all of these answers to questions that are just impossible. He's just so desperately unhappy. And we kind of suspect that he's never going to find happiness again. And that's so sad. But also, an awful lot of humor in the film. I loved the little ragtag band of criminals he had around them, and how they were just utterly useless without someone telling them what to do. It's a very impressive piece of work.
Excellent. Now, Chris, you want to do a wrestling movie next?
I do, yeah. The Iron Claw.
I'm being facetious.
The Iron Claw is, for me, I put it next to All of Us Strangers in that there were several films at the beginning of the year that should have been nominated for everything. And for whatever reason, they weren't. And I mean, with All of Us Strangers, you had just a career best performance from Andrew Scott that was just ignored by the BAFTAs and ignored by the Oscars, and it really shouldn't have been. And with this wrestling film, which tells the story of the Von Erich wrestling dynasty. Now, I'm not. Are you guys wrestling experts at all?
No. I think Aoife is.
I am not. Right. I know absolutely nothing about it.
But this is proper wrestling, like Olympic kind of. This isn't Hulk Hogan nonsense.
This is National Wrestling Association. Yeah. And the reason I asked if you were wrestling experts is because I went into this as I'm not a wrestling fan at all, and I knew nothing of the Von Erich clan, which were one of the most famous wrestling dynasties in America. And you had this, you had the patriarch of the Von Erich family, Jack Fritz Von Erich, brilliantly played here by Holt McElhaney, who had five or six sons in real life, and he never won this heavyweight champion belt for himself, but he decided to kind of, you know, build on this National Wrestling Association Foundation, have all these sons, and made it just his mission in life that one of these boys, you know, if not one of them, he'd just move on to the next one. One of those guys were going to bring home the belt, do something that he never could. And he pushed them so hard that just tragedy ensued for every one of his sons but one. And that is Kevin Von Erich, played just brilliantly by Zac Efron. Now, I don't want to give too much away, but I will say that the filmmaker Sean Durkin, who made this, he said that there was so much tragedy with the real life story of this family that they decided to leave out the death of one family member. That'll tell you how bad things are, that they had to actually just leave that out. That might be too much for the audience. So I don't want to give too much away, but it is essentially a story about, you know, a father pushing his boys too hard. It's a story about, you know, a boy kind of like realizing a little bit too late in life that, you know, he's kind of wasted these years following in his father's footsteps. I think he always kind of idolized his father, and he realizes that, you know, he's quite a toxic individual and not someone he should have been looking up to. You've got great performances in there from Harris Dickinson, from Jeremy Allen White, and like all the best sporting films, if even going back to, you know, The Wrestler with Mickey Rourke, or any great boxing drama, it's not really about the sport, is it? You know, and every good sporting film, they have a mission not to entertain you with the sporting aspect of the film, but with the drama. And I think that succeeds here.
Yeah, I think I remember at the time we reviewed this on the show, and I remember you being effusive about it. And I just made the point that Andrew, if you use a book analogy, Andre Agassi's autobiography, Open, is one of the best books I've ever read. And I don't mind tennis, but I know very little about it. But it had nothing to do with the tennis in a way, or needed to have no interest in the tennis whatsoever. Yeah, The Iron Claw sounded like a remarkable film from this year. Aoife, did you get to see The Iron Claw?
No, I didn't. And you know, you just reminded me that I meant to go see it because it came out quite early in the year, didn't it?
Yeah.
I think it starts, Harris Dickinson is in it, isn't he? As one of the brothers. And obviously he's in Baby Girl, which is coming out soon, which is my Wicked. I can't wait to see it. But yeah, so I was really interested in the cast, but no, I didn't see it. And I agree actually about the Andre Agassi book, Open. It's so great. So I think it's probably a good comparison that you don't have to know or wrestling or want anything to do with it to enjoy something about the personal stories too, which sounds really Absolutely. Dark.
Yeah, it does, but it sounds brilliant. So that's The Iron Claw from earlier in the year. You are listening to a special Screen Time where we're looking at some of the highlights on the big screen and indeed the small screen with Chris Wasser and Aoife Barry. En route to our first ad break, guys, I was just going to mention one movie I particularly enjoyed. Again, kind of earlier in the year, I think it was late January, early February, The Holdovers, where Alexander Payne back directing the great Paul Giamatti. He's a pretty uppity, dissolute, but kind-hearted teacher in a place called the Barton Academy in New England, if I'm not mistaken. The Holdovers make reference to the people who are going to have to stay there for the Christmas holidays in this preppy school whose parents, for various reasons, don't pick them up. And him and a cafeteria worker whose son has tragically died in Vietnam, who did go to the Barton Academy, Devin Joy Randolph, plays the cafeteria owner. So him and her, and then a student who stuck with them, played by Dominic Sessa, go off an adventure. It's set in the 70s. You know, it's not Sideways, but it has a very similar vibe to it, a kind of world-weary yet hopeful, melancholic movie that screams the 1970s and is just the kind of movie I enjoy immensely. And I said to people at the time, if you like Sideways, I think you'll really like this as well, because it has a similar vibe, even though it's a very different story. I think you both saw that one as well, right?
Yeah. Oh, it's so lovely. Yeah, it's just such a beautiful film, and it feels really Christmassy, even though it's really melancholic and very, very poignant and sad. But there's something really hopeful about like humans and how we can actually be good and we can get through tough experiences. And I think Dominic Sessa, like, he had never started anything before. I think they found him after like he did a school play or something like that. He's so great. And he looks really 70s as well. So, you know, he doesn't have that problem like someone like Channing Tatum, who tends to look like he's from the 21st century in every film he's in, you know. Whereas
no matter what he does,
he was in a film earlier this year that's set in the 60s, I think, and he does not look like he's from the 60s. But Dominic Sessa looks perfect for that role of that young kid.
Mm. Yeah, Chris, you saw it, didn't you?
Oh, I did. Yeah, it's a fabulous looking film as well. Yeah. And I think maybe Universal were the distributors there, and although the film got a pre-Christmas release in America, international distributors missed the trick by not having it in cinemas. And it's so nice then that you have cinemas like the Lighthouse and Palace and various others adding it to their Christmas season. This is how good that film is, that it's already been added to Christmas seasons this Christmas.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think if it wasn't for a very talented Cork man earlier this year, Paul Giamatti would have taken home that Oscar.
Yeah, very good point. I mean, I just think it was a travesty that Andrew Scott wasn't nominated for an Oscar.
Agreed.
Oh, absolutely.
Agreed.
I banged that drum too many times on this show, so we better move on. We will take a quick ad break and we will be back with lots more from the year that's been on the big screen.
From the makers of Rice-A-Roni comes Macaroni, a creamy, delicious boxed mac and cheese that's not just good, it's cheesy good. Macaroni will please even the pickiest eaters with two magnificent flavors that will melt your heart. Creamy cheddar and creamy white cheddar. If you love cheese, you'll love Macaroni by the makers of Rice-A-Roni. If you don't love cheese, well, that's just unbelievable. Try Macaroni. It's cheesy good.
Macaroni, the San Francisco treat.
A small screen. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time. We're coming to you at the later time of 9 p.m. this week. Of course, you can get us on a podcast any stage during the week on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app. If you want to get in touch with us, screentime@newstalk.com. I say us because I'm in the company of Chris Wasser and Aoife Barry this week, and we're taking a look at the best of the big screen and small screen. We've been talking mostly about the big screen, and we will continue to do so. I'm kicking myself, Aoife, because I haven't got to this, and it might be the movie of the year. I've yet to see it, but Anora, people have raved about, and you are too.
Yeah, there is so much hype, particularly in kind of, you know, cinematic social media, I think, around this. It was a really good campaign around it. And I was absolutely dying to see this. And This film was kind of annoying in one way to me, because you know when you have those directors that you're like, oh yeah, I have to go see their films, I think I'll really like them, but like they're on the list and you don't quite get to them. That's what happened to me with Sean Baker. I didn't get to see The Florida Project. It's long been on the list. Tangerine's long been on the list, which he famously filmed on an iPhone. And I kept thinking, okay, I'll get to it, I'll get to it. Eventually got to see one of his films, which is Anora, and then swiftly realized I should have watched his other work up to this point. Anora is really interesting film. I mean, there's parts of it that to me I didn't maybe love, but overall I thought it was just such a great cinematic work. It's about directed by Sean Baker, like I said, about an exotic dancer played by Mikey Madison, and who is just amazing, sparky, charismatic, believable performer. And one night she's working and she dances for a really young Russian guy, and because she's the only person who works in that particular club who can speak Russian or can understand it at least, she ends up working for him. And the two of them strike up this kind of relationship and end up, and this isn't a spoiler because you find this out when you watch the trailer, they end up on a whim getting married in Las Vegas. And things rapidly unravel from there because she doesn't know anything about his background. She just knows he's got a lot of money. It turns out that he's the son of a Russian oligarch. And it's a film that's kind of like, a fairy tale, kind of Disney film, gone bad. It's very realistic in many ways. It's set in a specific part of Brooklyn where there's a big Russian neighborhood. Sean Baker famously writes, directs and edits his own films, which is so unusual in Hollywood. He's always been outside of the Hollywood system and done his own independent thing. And this has really seen him come into that world where now we're thinking, OK, there's going to be Oscar nominations for this. And what does it say about him and his process, etc., etc. He really loves focusing on small communities that are not represented on screen. So you just get a lot of real tangible stuff that's going on here around what it's like to be a sex worker, a young sex worker in 2024, what it's like to be the son of an oligarch. But it's also really funny, and there's really hilarious scenes and really poignant scenes involving a guy called Yuri Borisov, who is a Russian actor people might have seen in the film Compartment Number 6, who is absolutely brilliant. Loads of heart to it. The final scene, I went to see it with a friend of mine. I turned around, she was crying at the end of it. It really, really touches people. I think there's kind of a feminist perspective on it that you could spend an hour or two talking about. That's really knotty and complicated, but I still really loved this film.
Okay. Chris, have you seen Anora?
No, I'm going to embarrass myself, John, say that I haven't gotten around to it just yet. I have seen everything else that Sean Baker has done, if that helps. And I am a big fan. I am a big fan of his work. I like the way, as Aoife touched upon there, like he does kind of craft these stories around these marginalized communities that aren't otherwise represented on screen. His protagonists are always these kind of oddball, eccentric loners who you're totally rooting for, even though you know that things are probably going to go sideways for them. Having been a fan of like Red Rocket, The Florida Project, Tangerine, and also the gonzo kind of filmmaking approach that sometimes he uses in these things, like every now and then you can spot that, oh, these guys are just running around streets with an iPhone sometimes filming these things. And I find that very impressive. And I also love that he gives these big shots to actors who wouldn't usually get a shot, in the studio system, whether it was with Simon Rex for Red Rocket, or with Mikey Madison, who we kind of know as something of a screen queen up until Anora. Like, he's giving these young actors a chance to kind of know, look, they're leading men and women, and I'm going to put them front and center of the story. So very much looking forward to catching this before the end of the year.
Yeah, me too, because the one movie of his, maybe it's two, but Red Rocket is a brilliant alt kind of indie film that isn't quite like anything else. So I can't wait to see Anora. I will get to it this Christmas. Chris, we're going to go Irish next, if that's okay, and jump down to small things like these. This was rightly praised. I'm assuming you think all the praise was worthy and deserved.
I think the praise was deserved for small things like these, John. It was shortly before watching this film that I decided to read the Claire Keegan novella on which it's based. And I'm glad I did, because I was kind of wondering what Enda Walsh, who's the screenwriter here, Tim Mylands is the director, but I was wondering what Enda Walsh was going to do with this story, because if you're hiring Enda Walsh, you're hiring for a very specific kind of story. For such a positive, charming, friendly man, sometimes his stories are quite bleak, and small things like these is a very dark tale. But in Claire Keegan's novella, there is an awful lot of light there too, so I was wondering how he was going to make it his own. And I think it's just a wonderful companion piece to the novella. For anyone who hasn't read it, it is set in New Ross in Wexford in the mid 1980s, and it follows this quiet, shy man named Bill Furlong, who is a married father of five and a very hard worker. Just goes about his days, you know, keeps the head down, gets
delivering
done what he's
coal, very
gritty coal. Yeah, he's this wood and coal merchant who runs his own business and has been quite successful. But he doesn't, you know, he never really, you know, upsets the order of things. He just keeps his head down. And as his wife, Eileen Walsh, portraying the wife character here, always says to him, you know, just like we just kind of stick to ourselves. And unfortunately, he has a problem sticking to himself after he sees something on one of his delivery rounds. And he's delivering coal to the local convent. And he begins to suspect that there is Magdalene Laundry in this convent, and that, you know, obviously the girls are being horrendously mistreated in here. And his wife and everyone around him, including the local publican, they're just saying, look, keep yourself to yourself. You want your girls to continue being educated in the local school. You want the business to still be, you want to remain working. You can't say anything. But the closer that he gets, and even on his next round, and even after an exchange with Emily Watson's mother superior, he just starts to think to himself, I might have to do something here. It's a very delicate tale, and I think it's very well handled, because if you don't lean into these kind of things, audiences might come away and they'll say, well, what's the point in setting up that story if you're not going to do anything with it? But if you go too much into it, you know, that can also be a little bit problematic. And I think maybe Tim Mullins and Enda Walsh and Killian Murphy playing Bill Furlong here, they found the right balance. It's a very quiet film. It's one that only ever really talks when it needs to, a little like on Colleen Kuhn, because so many Irish films, I feel as though they talk themselves out of quality sometimes. You know, there's far too much dialogue. But with Killian Murphy, you don't really need that. And his eyes are working overtime here. It's a quiet but powerful performance. And in a year where he won the Best Actor Oscar for Oppenheimer, it feels a little silly to say that this is one of the best performances of his career, if not the best performance, but it sort of is, John.
Oh, no, I agree. And, you know, to quote Bob Dylan, his eyes, they contain multitudes, you know, or to paraphrase him, because he does so much by seemingly doing so little. It was an amazing performance. And the quietness of it, it's profound. It really is. Aoife, did you get to it?
This is where I get to embarrass myself and say, I have not seen the biggest Irish film of the year. I was on holidays, I think, around the time it came out. Okay. And between one thing and the other, I missed it. But I also feel, I've read the book when it came out, which I loved. Very dark. I also found that because I was hearing so many different opinions about it, and because I knew it was going to be a dark film, it's actually quite hard sometimes, I think, to slot into your life in quite a dark year going to see something that's actually quite dark when you go beyond, I think, that initial excitement of it landing in the cinema. So I wonder if that's been partly why I've been a little bit slow in going to see it, despite being a fan of Enda Walsh, Killian Murphy, and the book itself. But I think what struck me from talking to other people is that there's been a real kind of variety of opinions on the quietness, the slowness of it that Chris was talking about there. And that intrigues me. So yeah, that is on my have to see this before the end of the year list, because maybe Killian might get an Oscar nod for it, probably not, but you never know. There might be something unexpected might happen.
Yeah, well, talking of quiet and slow Irish movies, take a listen to this.
The days were quiet. They're still here. Never thought they'd last.
Through them ran the sense, like an underground river.
And will he never have children?
Maybe there's enough people in the world, Patrick.
That there would come a time when these days would be looked back on as happiness. All that life could give of contentment and peace.
They're happy, lad. Is that what you're saying?
So what more can you ask for?
I'm moving on.
What will happen to the gallery?
We can only keep it in the family, as it were, if you come back and take over.
It still feels like we just live here day to day.
But isn't that the beauty of it?
Now, that was a clip from a movie that I think came out during the summer, based on the John McGaher novel of the same name, That They May Face the Rising Sun. Aoife, I was delighted that you had this on your list. Tell us why.
Oh, I just thought it was so beautiful. I saw it twice. It's directed by Pat Collins, and I was really lucky to get to interview him after one of the screenings in the Lighthouse. And as you both know, there's nothing more exciting than interviewing a director about their film and getting to ask them all the questions that you want to ask them. And he's, you know, such a long time, like, stalwart part of the Irish filmmaking scene, makes a lot of documentaries and made a few features. And he's got quite a slow pace to how he makes his work. And this is an adaptation of the John McGaren book, which is quite elliptical in a way. And it's a, you know, it's about a life in a community. The main character is a writer, quite similar to McGaren himself. He's living there with his wife in the small community. And it's about the year passing, the people who they meet, what it's like to just watch the world change around them, literally just nature change around them. Barry Ward stars as the main character in this, and he's so amazing in it. I think he's just so human and relaxed in the role, and you can see him, how he interacts with these older members of the community that he and his wife encounter throughout the film as it rolls on. And it's just very restrained in many ways. And the first time I watched it, I thought, oh, this is really slow moving. But the second time, because I was familiar with it already, it actually realized the pace was perfect for it. And the unfolding of the different relationships, there's death in it, there's a wake, you know, there's and creativity, these beautiful moments of kind of like poetry almost when he's reading out bits of his writing. It's just really beautifully made. And I think, you know, before it hit the cinemas, they were probably unsure as to how it would do, and it did really well. And I think Irish audiences love these sorts of films, and it was proof everything doesn't have to be massive kind of action films to grab audiences. People really appreciate the beautifully human stuff as well too.
Yeah, it was absolutely beautiful film. And I also interviewed Pat for it, and I just found him so delightfully down to earth.
Yeah.
For someone who makes quite artistic movies, he was quite rudimentary in his descriptions of the movie, in a very nice way, I felt. Chris, we're going to keep it Irish and quickly tell me why Kneecap deserves to be in a top list of yours or anyone's for movies of the year.
Well, I think when I first heard about the Kneecap film and the idea that, you know, these three guys were actually going to play themselves in their own biopic, I couldn't help but think of that Clint Eastwood film a few years ago. What was it, like the one set on a train, which was like a kind of a reconstruction of these army veterans saving the day when a terrorist tried to blow? Obviously, that's a very different story, but what I'm referring to is the fact that Eastwood thought it would be a good idea for real life people to play themselves in a film based on something huge that happened to them. And I thought, that's just a gimmick. That's not going to work. You need actors in order to, you know, tell this story, you know, efficiently and effectively. I just thought this might be, you know, this might take a bit of a wobble. John, sometimes critics get it wrong, and sometimes they shouldn't talk about it. Sometimes they shouldn't talk about things before they've watched the film, because I was so happy to sit there halfway throughout Kneecap and go, I was too early there with my criticism, because, you know, look, we don't expect any filmmakers to try and reinvent the music biopic. There are certain beats that these kind of stories and these kinds of films have to hit, but everyone behind Kneecap is really, you know, they're giving it a decent shot. I thought it was so inventive, so engaging. The music, the hip hop musical aspects of it are just, you know, they're bursting off the screen. So fresh, so just brilliantly performed, these numbers. Because, you know, Kneecap are a music group, and their songs, first and foremost, before the film, are just terrific in their own right. But the performances of these guys who've never acted before, and I know that they're playing themselves, but they were just so impressive. And even more so because they're surrounded by Irish acting heavyweights, and they're surrounded by Fassbender, and Michael Fassbender playing the father of one of them. So that was very impressive. The storytelling was great. The actual, I mean, like, where does the truth end and the kind of fiction begin and this sort of thing? It doesn't matter. Never let the truth get in the way of a good story. You know, this is semi-autobiographical. It's a bit of a biopic, but I loved it. I really did. And I know that there's an awful lot of buzz around it going into award season, that there is talk of potentially, you know, a Best International Film Oscar nomination for it. And a lot of people have been saying to me, oh, but, you know, does it deserve it? Is it just that thing where we're kind of just like hyping up an Irish film? It does deserve it.
Yeah, it was certainly wildly entertaining, and you may or may not need to park its take on politics, but you will certainly be entertained. And, you know, up until recently, I would have said the greatest cameo or strangest greatest cameo was Tom Cruise in Tropic Thunder. Jerry Adams made it. Let's park that one. We haven't got to any TV. We've about 2 minutes left in this part of the show before we do. So I want to go to one or two honorable mentions or just movies we didn't get time to. Aoife, quickly tell me why you've chosen The Outrun, starring Saoirse Ronan.
I think it's one of the best roles that she's ever played. She plays a woman called Rona, based on Amy Liptrot, who wrote this memoir called The Outrun, which is one of my favourite books over the last maybe 10 years or so. It's really beautiful. It's about addiction and about kind of going to an island, living on an island off the coast of Scotland for a while in an attempt to embrace solitude and figure out why addiction was happening in her life, and about her kind of recovery from all of that. And Saoirse Ronan has spoken about her personal connection to the topic, and it's really clear that herself and her partner Jack Loudon, who were co-producers on it, and the director Nora Fingscheid really just felt the story of Rona so deeply. It's beautifully shot, it's so like elemental, it just like eats up all these beautiful landscapes, and it's just got a really a career best moment, I think, for Saoirse Ronan. And it's a pity that like in the discussions around the Oscars, she's not really being chatted about, except by people who've seen the film and love it, and critics who are like, why isn't she being talked about? Because it's just so great. I absolutely loved it. It's really moving and a really beautiful film.
Yeah, I read the book as well. It's a brilliant book.
Yeah.
And you think you might have read books about people kind of recovering from addiction and stuff. This is a lot different, set up in the Orkney Islands.
Yeah.
I really liked it. And I remember getting it free at a press show and reading it almost by accident because I didn't have something to read and just been blown away by it. Chris, I want you to also tell me in quick fashion about The Beast and why it's on your top five list of the year.
You know what? A little bit like The Outrun, although they are very, very different films. The Beast is an incredibly tricky, tricksy, difficult picture at times, but it's a brilliant one and it's a rewarding one. And it's this, you know, epic, audacious, art house sci-fi that exists in a future where humans are no longer trusted to get things done, and their feelings are getting in the way of their, you know, commitment to their work and, you know, how they're running the planet. So these operations are set up around the world in around 2044, where, you know, AI is the way forward, and unemployment levels are at an all-time high. And humans start doing these tests where they're stripped of they're called DNA purification procedures, where they're stripped of their personality and their feelings. And once that's done, well, they'll basically just be like, you know, emotionless robots, and they'll be able to run the planet better. And we follow Lea Seydoux's character and also George Mackay's, who may have met in a previous life, or maybe, you know, either, you know, earlier on in this one or in a previous life altogether. And when they go in for their DNA purification procedures, they disappear into this sleep where they're actually allowed to visit these previous lives. So one of them is in 1910 in Paris. The other one is around, I think it's like around the 1960s. And then another one is around 2010. And they're all playing all these different versions of themselves, where they constantly, these two kind of, you know, star-crossed lovers, they're constantly, you know, things are getting just in the way of them being together. And Lea Seydoux's character starts to realize that, you know, if I want to actually be with this man in the real world, I can't continue with this procedure. So it's a little bit like, I kept thinking while I was watching it of Christopher Nolan's Inception, where you start to kind of think to yourself, wait, how is this dream box working, and what exactly are they doing, and how can they feel this? Stop asking questions. just the experience itself. The ideas are good enough if you don't overthink them. The performances are terrific, so long as you don't start kind of, you know, questioning like, wait, is that real? It's, you do kind of have to park yourself a little bit. You do kind of have to give over to some of the ambition, but I thought the performances were brilliant. I thought it was a stunning
You've made the case for it. I'm going to interrupt you, we're way out of time. Chris Wasser is talking about The Beast. Had we more time, Aoife would also have liked to have mentioned The Substance. I would have liked to have mentioned The Wild Robot. Chris would have liked to have mentioned the Christopher Reeve story, Superman, the Christopher Reeve story. However, we are at the end of part two. Chris Wasser and Aoife Barry will stay with me, because after the break we'll be looking at some of the best TV of the year. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time, News Talks TV and Movie Show, special show this week where Chris Wasser and Aoife Barry are talking to me about their favourite movies and TV shows of the year. We're in part three, we haven't got to any TV, so let's correct that now. We will start with Gary Oldman quite simply, being a prick, but a very entertaining one.
I don't normally do these kind of speeches, but this feels like a big moment, and if it all turns to shit, I might not see any of you again. You're f***ing useless. The lot of you. Working with you has been the lowest point in a disappointing career. Right. Cartwright, you're with me. What do we do? Well, try not to get caught for as long as you can. My money's on about 30 minutes.
Well, we can try and save Hassan.
Well, that'd be a sure way to get him killed. Go lock yourselves in a toilet somewhere.
That was a clip from Slow Horses. By golly, I only got around to this year, but me and my good lady wife, as some English man might say, watched it the whole 4 seasons in about 4 weeks. Absolutely brilliant TV, I felt. Slow Horses on Apple TV. Still lots of people haven't got around to it. We were treated to season 4 this year. I think you both are fans of it, but Aoife, I'll start with you. Slow Horses, why?
I just love this series so much. And I think this season wasn't the best season, but the fact that it's still one of my favourites of the year, I think shows the really high quality that you get. And I think part of the key to Slow Horses is if people don't know about it, it's about this group of spies who work for MI5 but are really terrible. And so they end up being sent away to this place called Slough House, which is where the name Slow Horses comes from. And they're basically sent there to kind of rot away for a little while. But they end up every season being involved in really, you know, important and big and sometimes terrifying cases. And they mess up all the time, but then they also do things, you know, quite well as well too at the same time. So I think there is there's an element of us sympathizing with them because they're losers, but also wanting them to do well. And among them, you have Gary Oldman, who basically rules the roost there. He is awful. He smells, he looks disgusting. He's basically, you know, has a drinking problem and he's really mean to people.
But he has a wind problem as well.
Like, if you don't like people farting, then this isn't the show for you. But no, he only does a few times. But he is this, you know, character who you love, even though he's really dislikable. And his little troop of slow horses, key amongst them is Jack Loudon as River Cartwright. And this is all based on a series of books written by McCarran. The books are great as well. I've read a few of them. They're excellent. In this season, Jack Loudon, he's been in all the seasons as River Cartwright, and you've been waiting for him to have his moment. And in this season, he does have his moment in the sense that he's a bigger character in it, and there's more surrounding him and his grandfather, who's played by Jonathan Pryce, who's amazing as always. Even though this didn't quite work as well as the other seasons, I think it showed how the characters are always brilliant. The dialogue is absolutely excellent. The kind of trajectory of where the plot goes keeps you on your toes and does feel believable even as it isn't particularly believable. And then you have side characters like Saskia Reeves, who deserves more focus, I think. Hopefully in the next season we'll get more of her, who's just so wonderful and poignant and sad, but also really powerful. She's an older female character, the likes of that we don't always get on screen. I just love sources to the point that the last time I was in London, which I go quite often because my sister lives there, I actually went to a little pilgrimage to find where their office is based by the Barbican and took a photograph of myself outside there. That is how tragically sad a fan I am of Slow Horses.
I salute that. That's a great way to spend a day in Lovin, or in London, not Lovin. Where's Lovin? Somewhere between Dublin
Lovin
and London.
Lovin London.
But folks, if you haven't tuned into Slow Horses, believe the hype. I think it's absolutely brilliant. It truly is. Chris, I know you're a fan as well, but I'm not going to let you talk about it because I want you to talk about a great Irish TV show that I love that we saw a second season of this year called The Dry, which I don't think has gotten the recognition it deserves.
Yeah, it's also had a bit of a funny staggered release in that, you know, UK audiences first saw the season one in 2022. And I think it was like maybe half a year before Irish audiences got it. They got the first season and then the second one was the same. But sure, look, we got season two earlier this year. And I think it's an Irish comedy drama series that's both funny and moving. And, you know, those things are sometimes rare on the small screen. And for the uninitiated, it tells this very simple story of an artist named Siobhan Shiv Cullen, played wonderfully by Roisin Gallagher. Wonderful Dublin accent as well from Roisin Gallagher, who's actually from Belfast. But she is this struggling artist who is also an alcoholic and has kind of just, her life has just gone, you know, completely sideways for her in London. And she returns home after a decade and she arrives home to a house where just everything is chaos. You know, there's her grandmother who has just died. There's her younger brother who might also have addiction issues. There's her mom who might have addiction issues. There's the, you know, small fact of her parents' crumbling marriage, Ciarán Hinds playing her father, Tom, in a lovely, lovely performance from Ciarán Hinds. And then there's also, you know, friends that she's hasn't seen in a while, a walking, talking red flag of an ex played by Mo Dunford. A lot to deal with. And season two just kind of expands on that and expands on Siobhan's recovery and how, you know, she can't ever quite rid herself of that ex, on her mother's recovery, on the fact that, you know, Ciarán Hinds is Tom, who's been living in this glorified shed out the back ever since he split from Shiv's mom, like what he's going to do with his life next. And also a new love interest played by Sam Keeley for Shiv. So a very small, simple story. But it tells it so well. You've got wonderful people behind the camera. You've got Nancy Harris creating and writing. You've got the awesome Patty Brathnick directing every episode. It's set, John, in a total imaginary version of Dublin, where just, you know, the weather is always great and everyone lives in the leafy suburbs and big houses. I mean, the shed that Ciarán Hinds is living in, you know, it'd be bigger than most people's apartments. Like so it is, you know, a bit of a fantasy in that respect.
Maybe I was slightly prescient when I said loving, you know.
But
it's also very funny. You know?
Oh, it is very funny. Yeah. Very moving. And also, again, I said that thing about, you know, a small screen Irish comedy that's actually funny. You know, where this is also one of those Irish comedies where the people behave and talk like real people. They might live in this imaginary version of the capital, but they are real people and their problems are relatable. So I just gobbled up the second season, and I would love, there hasn't been any news yet of a third run. I would love that. And do you know what else I would love? I would love for people to stop calling it the Irish Fleabag.
Because
I think that does a disservice to Nancy Harris's work and also Phoebe Waller-Bridge's work. Just because they're half-hour comedies about women who have an awful lot going on in their lives doesn't mean that they're the same thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I have it on good authority. Season three is in the pipeline.
Oh, great.
Great.
En route to, I live to bring joy. En route to your next choice of the top TV, I'm going to quickly mention, this is turning into the Andrew Scott Show, but Ripley on Netflix, again, earlier in the year, because what I was really impressed about this was I heard about this and I thought, what a waste of time. Why turn a good thriller from the 90s into an 8 or 9 part or whatever it is, Netflix TV show? And then Andrew Scott does this mesmerizing performance as this kind of guy who ingratiates himself into people's lives and ends up killing many of them. And what I was really thrown by was, it looks like some Italian art house movie. Black and white, slow paced, absolutely brilliant. So for my money, Ripley was one of the best shows on Netflix. Aoife, I was delighted to see, because I've only started watching season three of it 2 nights ago, the glorious and little appreciated, I think, Somebody Somewhere. Tell us about that.
Oh, I love this series so much. So this stars Bridget Everett, who people might have been aware of. I was aware of her as a cabaret performer in New York. She's a real kind of bawdy performer, to say the least. She's quite quite blue performances there in NYC, but she's originally from Kansas, and HBO approached her after some people from HBO saw one of her cabaret shows and they said, look, we'd like to work with you. She thought, oh yeah, sure, I'll take your money, but nothing's going to happen. And actually, this is what resulted, a story based loosely on her own life. So she plays a woman called Sam, who lives in a town called Manhattan in Kansas. Is obviously an irony there in the name of it. Her sister Holly, when we first get to the first season, her sister Holly has passed away from cancer, and Sam had moved back home to care for her sister. Sam's in her 40s, kind of mid to late 40s, and ends up, you know, sad and kind of depressed, grieving for his sister, her living in the town, working in a kind of a dead end job. While she's there, she bumps into a guy called Joel, who she used to go to school with. Joel remembers she's a great singer. And from there starts her friendship with Joel, her new friendship with other people in the community in Manhattan, her realizing she loves singing, loves playing piano. And we get to meet her friends, Joel, etc., but also her family members. Her family, they're all struggling with different things themselves, her sister and her marriage, her parents with her mother's alcohol addiction. And this feels like the kind of series from the first to third series where the stakes don't feel very high, and that there's no great action pieces, there's no massive mysteries, but actually the stakes are really, really high because they're human stakes. They are people dealing with really sad and really human and normal things that we all go through, grief, loss, you know, marriage problems, all this sort of thing. And you just love Sam and you want the best for her. She doesn't always want the best for herself. And in season three, she's really trying to find out how she can get her own kind of self-confidence back. But it's not done in a typically Hollywood way. She makes mistakes. She can be a terrible person sometimes. She can say mean things to people, but she feels distinctly real. And I love the series so much. And I think it makes you feel happy and sad and moved. And you'll be laughing out loud at some of the fart jokes in it as well, too. So it's got everything, I think.
It really has. And it's such a great slice of American life that isn't the East Coast or the West Coast.
Yeah.
And they're not hillbillies. There are hillbillies in it, but there's also very forward-thinking people. And it contains, again, multitudes. It's a great show and not like anything else.
Nothing like TV. It.
Chris, I was also delighted to see from Apple TV, you've gone for Shrinking, Jason Segel playing a very unorthodox therapist who's just going to tell it like it is to his patients, to strange effect at times.
Yeah, to very strange effect. And I don't think Shrinking is a perfect show at all, but we watch an awful lot. We watch an awful lot of television and film. And when we're reviewing television, I find that you'll start a series, you'll watch 3-4 episodes, and you might actually have to leave it at there because we just don't have enough time. But with shows like Shrinking, I'll finish that in 2 weeks if I can. You know, it's like that. It's something that I just wanted to come back to, despite its flaws, because it's quite comforting television. I mean, it is essentially, it's a little bit of a cozy hangout comedy that you just look forward to, you know, oh, I'll stick on half an hour of this. And part of that is down to the writing. I mean, the story is lovely. It is about this unconventional therapist played by Jason Segel, who also had a hand in the creation alongside Bill Lawrence. And he is, you know, his life is in bits. Like, you know, he's, you know, recovering from this awful family tragedy. He lost his wife in a car accident. His life has gone off the rails. And he decides, because he can't fix himself, that he might try to, you know, quote unquote, fix others. That rather than just kind of listening to his patients, he'll meddle with their lives. And sometimes that works, but most of the time it really doesn't. And he should be listening to his mentor, the guy who's running the place where he works, Harrison Ford, when he says that that's not what we're here to do. But I think most of the reason, the big reason why I keep coming back to Shrinking and why I'm always in such a hurry to finish it, is because it's the best role Harrison Ford's had in years. And he is just, I've had this thing throughout my whole life with Harrison Ford, where when I watched the Indiana Jones films, I thought, well, I want to be an archaeologist because that looks like so much fun, right? Right? You know, and then you'd see him in Air Force One. You think, well, if that's what being the U.S. president is like, then I should start now, you know. And with Shrinking, I'm still doing it. He's now in his 80s, and I'm now older, and I'm thinking to myself while I'm watching this, oh, I should have been a therapist. If I could be a therapist as cool as Harrison Ford, he is so cool here. But also, he's relishing the fact that he gets to play this grouchy mentor to all these younger therapists, but also there's an awful lot of heart there, because there's more to his life, and this, you know, he might not be as happy as it seems. And I love as well that he broke his one project a year rule for this thing, where he only ever does one performance a year, because he's Harrison Ford. He wants to get in there, do his performance, and then go off and spend his money and just kind of, you know, chill out. But with this, he liked the material so much that he thought, I'll do the films and I'll do this. And I'm very glad that he did, because it's a lovely show. Again, a bit flawed, a bit baggy at times, but it always makes my heart and soul feel better. And sometimes that's what you need when you're watching television.
Absolutely. And I agree with you. Not perfect, but wildly entertaining and somewhat comforting. And it might be daddy issues with Harrison Ford that me and Chris are both suffering from. And Chris, you mentioned, you know, watching something after you've done your work thing for it. That brings me nicely to Say Nothing on Disney. Aoife, I know you're a fan of this.
Yeah.
This is a show about the Northern Ireland Troubles. I had watched enough of that for the purposes of work, but I had to get to the end of it. It's been controversial. I'm not sure who's annoyed. Everyone's annoyed, but it's a great dramatic piece of TV.
It really is. It's so well made. I mean, it's just produced so well. Everything about it is, like, the costumes are beautiful and really, like, on point. The needle drops are great, although, as a friend pointed out to me, they're often dropping songs from the wrong era. But we're so used to that from the likes of Peaky Blinders that we kind of don't really notice these things anymore, I think. The cast are amazing. I think the key to this really is that a lot of the cast are from the North.
Yeah.
So you have Lola Pettigrew. They're amazing actor. Just really inhabits the character of Dolores Price, who they play. Dolores Price is such a fascinating character. A lot of this is based on the book written by Patrick Radden Keefe of the same name. I mean, it's all based on it, but his book is based on reality, of course. So you get Lola Pettigrew playing Dolores Price, you know, as a young person getting involved with the IRA. And then you also get the older Dolores Price as well, and you get the aftermath of what it was like to actually, you know, be someone who was there through the Troubles and involved in quite dark things. So you get the sense of what it was like to be a young person getting involved in, I suppose, radical action. And then you get the sense of what it's like to be older and to look back at what you did and think, was what we did worth it? And those are very controversial things to explore. And you can't forget while you're watching this that this isn't, you know, fiction. This is real life. A big part of this is about the disappearance of Jean McConville and whether or not Dolores and her sister Marion Price, who is in real life actually suing the company who made this over suggesting she had a role in it, over whether they had a role in this and what the kind of aftermath was. Jean McConville's disappearance and death is, when you read about it and learn about it, it will absolutely haunt you, I think, for the rest of your days. And people are still alive, her children are still alive, who went through all of this. So I think I watched this film with one eye on. It's an amazingly made piece of TV. It's produced really well. It does a really good job of reflecting Patrick Radden Keefe's book. But on the other side of this, there are real people who are affected by every single bit of this series. And so you're left, I think, juggling those two facts as you watch it. So I can see that why some people might not be happy with a piece of well-produced television being made out of one of the most horrific incidents that happened during the Troubles. But it does a really good job of doing what it does. And also a shout out to Anthony Boyle, who plays Brendan Hughes, a key IRA character in this. And he's amazingly charismatic in this role. And he's one to really watch to be coming up, I think, because he's had some amazing roles up to this too.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. There is a lot of stuff to talk about there on you know, the hand of history and what side people were on and all those kind of things. But it is a gripping piece of TV. I also want to give a shout out to Hazel Duke, who plays Dolores' sister in it, who's just brilliant in it. And she was also brilliant in a movie this year called Kathleen Is Here. Chris, I'm afraid we're out of time. I know you wanted to tell us about the Bonkbuster Rivals on Disney, but we don't have time. But I do agree, that was fun.
Yeah,
it was.
Which is, I think, is what you were going to say.
But yes.
We are out of time, I'm afraid, though. My thanks to regular reviewers on this show, Chris Wasser, who's an arts journalist and film critic. Also to Aoife Barry, who is an author, and you could do worse than giving a thinking person in your life her book, Social Capital, Life Online in the Shadow of Ireland's Tech Boom.
Thank you.
She's also a journalist. They've been highlighting the best movies and TV shows. You can listen back to this of 2024, not of all time. We need a lot more time. Of 2024. You can listen back to this show on the News Talk app or wherever you get your podcasts. We will be back to our normal time, a normal show next week. I will be talking to the great Kerry Washington and also the great Barry Jenkins, the director and writer of Moonlight, and why he wanted to make a new version of The Lion King. All of that to come next week. Again, my thanks to Chris and Aoife. I'm going to leave you with a song from the movies. The best use of a song in a movie this year that I saw was from a good Irish movie starring Peter Coonan called King Frankie, and right at the end of it and at the start of it we hear this gorgeous song from Ye Vagabonds called Blue Is the Eye. So I will leave you with that and wish you a happy remainder to your weekend.
A crack in the sky lends a light to the dark. The wind blows the ember cold from the heart. You carry it proudly through ditches and trees and cross the horizon to lie down and sleep.
Screen Time with John Fardy.
Thanks to Airtainment.
Saturdays at 6 p.m. on News Talk.